You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There has been no shortage of media attention focused on Detroit in recent years. As the Detroit auto industry teetered on the brink of extinction in 2008, the big news outlets and the major networks dispatched writers, photographers, and reporters to Detroit. Time magazine even bought a house in Detroit and embedded a team of reporters to cover what appeared to be a disintegrating auto industry and a disintegrating city. Rarely were those reports done by people who had grown up in Detroit or the Tri-County area, Metro Detroit. Rolling Stone writer Mark Benelli did. He grew up in St. Clair Shores. And although his writing career has taken him to New York City, he has plenty of ties to Detroit. And that makes his new book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, the afterlife of an American metropolis so packed with perspective and with insight. Mark Benelli joins us now in the studio. Good to have you here, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have to say, I devoured your book, and I'm a lifelong Metro Detroiter. I grew up in Ferndale. I live in Oakland County. And there was my first inclination was to think, well, what is he going to say that I don't already know? But you really tell us Detroit's story of its rise and fall with a lot of humor and a lot of heart. What led you to just tackle this project in the first place?
Well, thanks so much for saying that. First of all, it's great to hear from a fellow native Michigander. I guess I started, the book came out of an assignment for Rolling Stone in 2009. I was sent here to cover the auto show, and you well remember, I'm sure.
It was a grim one.
It was a very dire time. Chrysler and GM were on the verge of bankruptcy. The mayor was in jail. And Detroit had sort of become the poster city of the recession, essentially. Reporters were coming not only from all over the country, but all over the world.
True.
To photograph our ruins and, make Detroit a metaphor for something, some sort of metaphor for the recession. And I felt like as a native, I could, bring a little bit more nuance to the story. Things like I'm really glad you mentioned humor, because I think that's something that's really doesn't come out in a lot of reporting about Detroit. It's always the grimmest.
It's all apocalyptic.
Yeah.
When
in fact, Detroit is, again, as you know, it's a really weird, funny place. And, they're filled with characters. And so, I wanted to sort of present the sort of spectrum of Detroit. It's not just the Detroit that people often see.
You give us a very clear picture of Detroit as a post-industrial frontier. And when you think about our history and the westward movement and the frontier, it meant opportunity, not necessarily destruction and gloom and doom. Is that what you've discovered as you're getting to get a sense of Detroit in 2012?
I'd say so. I end the book on a note of sort of cautious optimism. I mean, there's definitely, such a long list of problems the city faces that seem difficult to imagine how they'll be overcome. But one of the things that made me feel optimistic was exactly that sense of sort of bottom-up potential. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean I have a chapter in the book called DIY Detroit. There's sort of a do-it-yourself possibility in a city like Detroit, which is, for all intents and purposes, a failed state. I mean, a lot of the city just does not have a functioning government. The one upside of that, though, is it opens things up in a weird way, so you can there's lots of stuff happening on a micro level that is very exciting. Things like the urban gardening gets written about a lot, and that's basically people taking something that is negative. All these houses are gone, all this empty space, and turning it into an asset. Growing food there and feeding a community that is sort of underserviced.
Very much so. Yes.
I found a whole range of things happening along those lines, from people throwing blues concerts, these sort of DIY blues concerts out in the middle of these blasted out neighborhoods, to, of course, the artists who get written up a lot, and just, entrepreneurs in general who can snatch up really cheap real estate and turn it into maybe try to do something that they wouldn't be able to do in a healthier city.
You spend time in the book talking about that uptick of especially younger white residents moving back in the city. You're talking about some of the neighbors you have in your area where you live near Eastern Market. What I found intriguing was the response or the reaction of the black residents who can't get over these, like these young white people rollerblading and walking. Talk a little about that psychology of fear that they've lived under, and they can't get over these, the white residents.
Yeah, you're talking about one specific person I interviewed, and I don't want to that broad of a brush, but it's an interesting observation. Yeah, no, for sure, and I think you know there are sort of tensions in both directions, mm-hmm. right? As the suburbs get more diverse, there'll be tensions there. Mm-hmm. But the same thing is happening in the city with these, you know, hipsters coming into places like Corktown. And one longtime, lifelong Detroit, black Detroit resident, I was hanging out with. We were driving around one day, and she saw these two kids with beards, you know, the white kids with beards, sort of just standing on a corner. And she had this whole great monologue about, you know, how white people can move into a neighborhood and they throw their windows open, they take the bars off, and you know they're rollerblading around and they've got chickens in the backyard and she had a great riff about this idea of the psychology of fear. Like, do people like that coming from presumably a more privileged background bring with them the expectation of police protection, like the police will come if they call the cops, if there are problems.
Which, like, I'm sure she did not have.
She also pointed out things like, you know, so-called urban explorers, like kids, you know, and not just kids, adults, mm-hmm. going into abandoned factories and building and taking photos. She sort of pointed out that if you're, you know, some white kid from the suburbs doing that and you get caught, you'll probably just be sent home. If you're, you know, black kids from Detroit would probably receive a sterner reception if they were caught. So that's all interesting.
Mark Benelli, I want to get your take, if I can, on some topics and personalities that you explore in your book, just to give people kind of a sense of what you've learned and what you tell. The big three automakers and the auto bailout.
That was interesting because, as I said, you know, I arrived initially to do that story. And weirdly, I mean, I got there in January 2009. 3 days later, I was watching President Obama's inauguration from from the Anchor Bar in Detroit, mm-hmm. if people know that bar.
Yeah.
And so the book, even though I didn't intend it to this way, it became a sort of snapshot of President Obama's first term, basically from ground zero of the recession. And it was interesting to watch this last campaign unfold in the way in which the president made the auto bailout the centerpiece of his campaign. And, you know, I think rightfully so. It was a signature accomplishment. I would also say, though, that it reminded me in certain ways of the bank bailout in that it was a transfer of taxpayer money to these huge multinational corporations. And not enough of the upside seemed to be trickling down to regular people. I mean, it definitely made these companies profitable again. People in places like Michigan and Detroit, in Ohio rather, who now have jobs mm-hmm. again, are very grateful, of course. But these new jobs are half.
They're not paying as much.
It's basically half of what, you know, starting jobs were mm-hmm. pre-bailout. So they're not the sorts of jobs that made Detroit great once upon a time. And so it's complicated. You know, could more have been squeezed out of the companies? I'm not sure. Yeah. But
Kwame Kilpatrick.
he's a character. So funnily enough, with Kilpatrick, I had actually spent some time with him way back in 2002 for an article in Rolling Stone that never ended up running. But at the time, he was loved by everyone. I remind people in the book that this was right around the time Chris Rock was mm-hmm. making a movie called Head of State, where he was playing the first black president.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
And he, in interviews, said he was modeling his character not after Obama, who nobody, I think, even knew at the time.
Sure.
But after Kwame Kilpatrick. He was a loved figure. I mean, I traveled. I spent a couple of days with him. We went to some sort of Chamber of Commerce thing in Grand Rapids, which is not necessarily very friendly to Democrats. And people loved him. I mean, he just charmed the crowd. He was the keynote speaker. And then the next day I went with him and he spoke at a Baptist church in Detroit, all black Baptist mm-hmm. preachers. Again, they loved him. But I could also, you know, and he was just speaking to him one-on-one, brilliant, charismatic, but you could see the seeds of the troubles that mm-hmm. would become his undoing. I mean, the night ended, it was Angels Night. So I was going out on patrol with him. the night ended with he and his sort of the guys around him were going back to the Mayoral Mansion, which was under construction at the time, to get massages. It was midnight, I think, 12:30. His wife was somewhere else. They were speaking about this right in front of me, which I was like, huh, that's how credulous should I pretend to be? But, you know, it was interesting, yeah.
Coleman Young,
he was, you know, again, growing up in the 70s in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my mind, my memory of him sits side by side with the Ayatollah Khomeini, just in the way that they were both these demonized figures from my childhood who I didn't, you know, I was too young to really understand
sure.
what was going on, but just the way they were spoken about by adults. And so really studying up on his legacy and reading about him, and particularly reading his autobiography, Hard Stuff, which is so funny and entertaining and profane as he was. I kind of fell in love with him as a historical figure. And I mean, one of the problems with this writing this book was just making it a reasonable length and not, you know,
seven
chapters on Coleman Young alone, which
sure.
you could do. I hope somebody is working on a serious biography of Coleman Young, because that's really such an amazing story, and his life covered so many interesting periods of 20th century American history.
And certainly was a lightning rod
yeah.
of controversy.
Yes.
The sheer size of the vacant land in Detroit, the urban prairie. You talk a lot about that in your book.
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhere between 30 and 40 square miles. So that's like Paris, basically.
That's like Paris.
You know,
wow.
San Francisco.
Sure,
So, yeah, that's the big question. What do you do with that? And another reason to be excited, I think, about the future of Detroit is are these right-sizing initiatives, this talk of, you know, moving people into denser urban cores mm-hmm. and doing creative things with the vacant land, farms,
mm-hmm.
green space, all manner of things. I mean, you see some of these renderings of Detroit in 2020 or 2030, and it's so exciting. But of course, you need money to do these things, and that's where the pessimism comes in. I mean, I really, with the city on the verge of bankruptcy, it won't be cheap.
We're talking with author Mark Benelli. His book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis. Mark, you talk about the interesting characters you meet, and I want to have you just tell us a little about that weekly blues concert that you went to, put on by a relative of Joe Louis. And I love the guy you met, one of the bikers, and here's his quote, "They call me Satan, but my name is Joe." Tell me a little about getting past the initial looking at someone and just pigeonholing them into, well, that's what this guy's mm-hmm. like. You learned a lot.
Yeah, I think Detroit, it's really important to just start talking to people, because you're perpetually surprised. I mean, you mentioned the guy putting on the concert,
yeah.
Who's this sort of older guy, retired auto worker, you know, and this sort of goes back to your last question, too. What do you do with all this vacant space?
Yeah.
This is a neighborhood on the east side that used to be tightly packed residential neighborhood, people working at the Poultown plant primarily. And now most of those houses are gone. It's the type of neighborhood where you'll see one or two houses on a block, and the rest is literally a field with grass that will, you know, come up to your waist. This guy, Pete Barrow, saw this happening, ended up just basically taking over a few of the fields himself, mowing the grass, setting up this kind of crude stage built out of some pallets, and started hosting these weekly blues concerts. And they're packed. I mean, people just come, and you feel like you're in Mississippi or something. I mean, it's this
very organic,
really amazing scene. And talking to him, yeah, he just sort of very casually at the end of the conversation just mentioned his cousin Joe Louis. And I said, what? Yeah, that's, you're yeah. burying that at the end? And it was, that wasn't even a big deal to him. He just kind of like sort of, it was just an aside. So that was funny. And then this guy Satan, yeah, I noticed there were a lot of bikers at the show, at the blues show I went to. And so I don't know. He was the most interesting looking one. He had sort of an interesting looking beard and a lot of tattoos. And I chit chatted with him, and it turned out, yeah, he said his name was Satan. I was like, okay, this is going to be interesting. But then it turned out his job before he got hurt in a motorcycle accident, so he wasn't doing this anymore. But he used to dive and do underwater work on like oil rigs or something. So really, really interesting, complicated life. He'd been a cop at one point. So yeah, Detroit really rewards you. I mean, particularly as a writer, if you're willing to kind of just get out there and strike up a conversation with people. I mean, some of the best characters in the book are just people I randomly met. I mean, of course, I went the sort of more traditional route too, and I interviewed Mayor Bing and I interviewed the chief of police.
Sure.
And I, you know, but I really, my favorite characters in the book are just random people.
The title is Detroit City is the Place to Be. Why'd you pick that title?
Well, it's from mm-hmm. an old Ted Nugent song,
yep.
Which was appealing. The main reason was because it's about this moment in time, beginning around 2009, when Detroit achieved this weird sort of trendiness, you know, for, you know, in good and bad ways. You know, there were people coming to sort of gawk at the ruins. There were people who'd never been to Detroit, who were, you know, eating up these stories about Detroit to make themselves feel better about their own city. But then there's a sort of oddly positive aspect to being branded the worst city in the country, I think. And that is, you know, people will pay more attention to you. And the sorts of people who think about cities have been paying special attention to Detroit because it's, as a friend told me, and I quote her in the book, it's sort of like the unsolvable math problem for urban planning types. So if you can fix Detroit, you can fix Scranton, you can fix Stockton. Mm. That won't be a problem. So it's an exciting time here.
Mark, what are your thoughts of what might become of Detroit, let's say, in 20 years?
It's really hard to say, you know. I mean, I the book is, we've just been discussing, it's not really a policy book. It's more like a snapshot of this moment in time. So, I mean, you know, I would hope that some of these plans to sort of change the shape of the city could come to pass. I mean, that would be really exciting. Another thing that I think has been positive has been the way the economy seems to be diversifying. I mean, historically, Detroit has all been all about cars, cars, cars. Mm-hmm. Now you really are seeing, particularly downtown, with the sorts of things Dan Gilbert is doing, people like him, more tech companies, more just sort of general entrepreneurial hubs. So I would think probably the future would be not holding out for GM opening a plant that employs 5,000 people, but maybe 50 people opening small businesses mm-hmm. that employ, you know, 50 people each or something like that.
Sure.
So that kind of stuff and hopefully more regional cooperation. I mean, I think that would be the other thing that I would think people would finally wise up about and realize, you know, if there could be more resource sharing, there could be lots done if people work together.
The book is Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis, out from Metropolitan Books. And we've been talking with Mark Benelli, the author. Mark, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortesoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow at 3:00.